From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Donations are flooding into the ALS Association as people across the globe are pouring ice water over their heads. The Ice Bucket Challenge. Donate to ALS Research or Feel the Freeze. Many celebrities and politicians included are doing both and posting videos of it online on Facebook. Over $50 million raised in a stunning outbreak of viral philanthropy and wet T-shirts. This hour on Point, how social media is changing how and why we give to charity. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you taken the Ice Bucket Challenge? Is this a summer frolic or the future of giving? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's just a few. Former President George W. Bush, actress Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Kermit the Frog, Jimmy Fallon and the Roots, all doing the Ice Bucket Challenge.
Oh! Ah! 2, 1.
It's all over the country. It's all over the world. LeBron James doing it on a yacht in Greece and much more humble backyard performances as well. And more than $50 million now raised for ALS. We want to look at this story, the backlash to it. There has been one. People hating on the Ice Bucket Challenge, calling it slacktivism, but also the just awe at the amount of money that's been raised for a good cause. Joining me now from Belmont, Massachusetts, is Nancy Frates. Her son, Pete, a Division I college baseball player, captain of the Boston College team, was diagnosed with ALS in 2012. The Ice Bucket Challenge took off when Pete and his friends got involved. Nancy Frates, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
How did you all first even learn about this? It's just at the very end of July that anybody was pouring ice buckets on their heads.
Well, sure. Well, how we learned about it was that we got tagged. We got nominated. Pat Quinn, a fellow young man who has ALS and a good friend of Pete's, had seen the Ice Bucket Challenge that's been around for other charities and started with his family and friends out on Long Island. His brother nominated on, I believe it was July 27th, Pete's roommate from Boston College, the families are very close with us.
Yeah.
And then he tagged into Pete's network, and that's when it started. So yep. I saw it probably end of July is when I started seeing him. July 27th, we all started getting nominated.
Here's the sound of your husband, John, taking the Ice Bucket Challenge. Here we go. Whole wheelbarrow of ice poured on Pete's dad, your husband. It's kind of quiet, but that could be the sound of gold coins, practically. Can you believe the amount of money that's been raised, Nancy, through this kind of goofy but wonderfully effective fundraising way?
We're overwhelmed and overjoyed. ALS has been a misunderstood and underfunded, quote unquote, rare disease, not just in the 75 years since Lou Gehrig was diagnosed, but even prior to it, when it was first discovered. We are, like I said, just overjoyed. And the $50 million plus is what the ALS Association is reporting. That's only one organization. I'm here to tell you that we hear from large and small organizations from all over the country. And when I say small, I mean caregiver funds that the medical costs associated with this disease to a family is enormous. And everyone has a fundraising page for their patient. Even they are feeling enormous growth and enormous effect from this. So to try to quantify the totality of how much money is being raised for ALS as a community, I would venture a guess it might even be double that number.
No, we're really getting huge. What's your expectation, Nancy, that this is a one-time thing, a summer 2014 fad? Do you think this will go on in support of ALS, or is it here and gone?
Well, I think the most important thing is there a permanent, sustaining, and consistent effect on the trajectory of this disease that literally was going very, very slowly towards a treatment and cure. And I do believe that the effect is enormous. When and we'll just take the ALS Association as one example. When they're telling you that they have more than 500,000 new donors, we're talking database. They now have so first of all, more than 500,000 people have put pen to paper that to a check that have never done that for ALS prior to this. That's enormous. The second piece of this ripple effect goes even further. So the events that we have a walk to defeat ALS, the galas, all those numbers are up. We can see it ourselves. We have a pretty good network, but even our network has grown exponentially. The thing about ALS is, Tom, once someone is affected by it in their sphere, they never forget it. And once you read stories of ALS patients, it lingers with you because we've all heard of Lou Gehrig. We've all heard of those three letters, ALS, and take for my son, for example. I think when you look at a vibrant, athletic, charismatic, successful 27-year-old young man who is told that he has a disease that may take his life within 2 to 5 years, and to see this beautiful young man who's still there in his spirit, in his heart, in his brain, but physically be taken away from us little by little every day, to a point where today he is completely disabled in a wheelchair. He can't speak any longer. He can't swallow food anymore, so he's therefore on a feeding tube.
Yeah.
And we're watching his breathing capacity right now.
But he's got his mind, and he must be watching this, and he must be amazed by what he and his friends and your family helped really get started here, Nancy.
He told us day one, Tom. Day one, he sat us down. As you can well imagine, as a parent, I couldn't even really get out a coherent sentence. And he looked at us and he said, "There'll be no turning back. We're looking forward. This is an opportunity. ALS community is now my team, and I'm going to change the face of this disease."
Nancy,
that was March 12, 2012.
That's amazing. Here we are in 2014, and certainly there's a change in the funding coming in. We're going to talk later in this hour with the chief scientist at the ALS Association about how some of this money may be used. Nancy Freitas, mother of Pete, congratulations on what got kicked off here, and good luck to all of you. Thank you so much for joining us, Nancy.
Well, Tom, thank you to you, and thank you to all your listeners for supporting the ALS.
Thank you. Nancy Freitas there, right back at the beginning of public awareness here. 1939, baseball great Lou Gehrig was diagnosed with ALS. Here's his famous speech saying goodbye to his fans and his sport at Yankee Stadium.
Jay, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. I've been given a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for.
Lou Gehrig himself, and here in 2014, the entire New York Jets takes the Ice Bucket Challenge. Down it comes, a rain of ice and icy water and millions of dollars. Stacey Palmer is with us right now from Washington, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Stacey, thanks for joining us. It's $50 million today. Has there ever been such an explosion of giving focused on one point in such a short period of time, Stacey?
No, this is phenomenal. With the exception of disaster giving, you know, when people give after September 11th or something like that, that's when we've seen these kinds of numbers. But never to a cause like this has it taken off so much. And just to give you a perspective, $50 million is more than almost all the charities in this country raise in a year. Only the 400 biggest charities in the country raise more than that in a year. The fact that this has come in a month is just incredible.
So is everyone in the realm of philanthropy celebrating, saying we found a new way to shake the tree and bring in all kinds of resources, or what?
people are excited about the fact that social media is taking off as a fundraising tool, because I think everybody's been wringing their hands for a while and saying, why can't we figure out a way to raise money on this thing? So people are excited about it. I think there's a little bit of envy and also a little bit of concern that perhaps people have given so much money that they might not have as much left for the other good causes. So there's a lot of debate about it, but I think mostly what people are thrilled about is that they finally see a path for how social media can be used to raise money for good causes. We know it's great at getting people excited and energetic and active in things, but we've not seen it raise money before.
I mean, yes, they've raised a lot of money, but given so much, you know, it's sort of, they say, well, give $10 if you pour the water over, or if you don't, $100. I've been challenged, didn't do the bucket, I guess I'll do the $100. But is it so much that they've given, or so many have given a little each?
That's what is the incredible thing. It's at both ends. The fact that you have people like Bill Gates doing this and some very big donors making tremendous gifts, and then you've got people just giving the $10, to see that that adds up. I think that's part of the powerful message here, is that it can all add up to something like $50 million. And let's think about it. The Salvation Army raises money that same way. That money you dump in at Christmas time, that all adds up.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Ice Bucket Challenge, the summer's wild viral fundraiser for ALS, and the future of giving in the age of social media. Many call it great and fun. It's raised a lot of money. Some still call it slacktivism, but $50 million or more is in the bank as a result of all that ice and water and giving. With Stacey Palmer, she's editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, a realm where everybody has just watched with amazement as this has taken off just since the end of July. Here's a whole bunch of people doing it. Justin Timberlake, Weird Al, the New York Giants, Mark Zuckerberg, all doing their separate ice bucket challenges.
The only thing that would make this better is if I had a big bucket of ice water dumped on my head right now. Awesome!
One, two, three.
That was really cold.
It's been done again and again and again. Here's Ben Stiller and Christine Taylor, skeptical, but have ice water dumped on them anyway.
Okay, we're doing the ice bucket water challenge for Project ALS. Project ALS. Anything to find a cure, though I'm not sure what the exact scientific connection is between getting ice water dumped on you and finding a cure, but okay. And I nominate Judd Apatow and Ricky Gervais.
And of course?
And Rafael Nadal.
Tennis star Rafael Nadal.
Yes, Rafael Nadal.
So that's
it.
Nominate as in, hey, you guys do it too, or pay up. Here's Steven Spielberg.
Oh, man, that's cold!
It's all over. Here's Oprah. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Oprah's a little chilly right there, and now you know it. Mary in Medfield, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Mary. What do you think?
I think it's unbelievable. I have teenagers that have done it and nominated all their friends. I've had friends with three-year-olds who nominate their grandparents. I've seen political figures, sports teams. I think it's caught on like wildfire. I think it levels the playing field for everybody having fun with it, and I think it's just a great idea.
So bring it on. More of it. Mary, I appreciate your call. Krista in Winchester, Virginia. Krista, you're on. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
When this first came out, it concerned me greatly in that in involving children in it, it brings up, for me as a mother of three adolescent boys, I'm trying to train them to look at internet dares and shaming and bullying in a critical manner. And seeing that teachers and celebrities and so forth are encouraging this and teachers involving children in this, to me, sets up a greater culture of dare on the internet for kids to deal with. In addition to that, I've seen bosses challenging their staffs to do it and so forth. And I'm just, you know, it's difficult for me to understand how, as an employee of an organization or as a child, how do you stand up and say, no, I don't want to do this dare.
But I mean, it's, I get it. It's peer pressure, and a lot of parents work with their kids on that. On the other hand, it's a bucket of cold water for a good cause. Is that a big deal, Krista?
I think that in our culture, there is a culture of one-upmanship, and on the national news today, there was a report that hazing has increased on college campuses in the past year. So I think there is an issue here. I think that it's a good model for adults to give, but when you get children involved in it, I think it's a slippery slope.
So Krista, we've got it. My time is short. Let me take it to Stacey Palmer. Stacey, you know, a boon for ALS in giving or undermining the moral fiber of the nation?
I think people are using it to talk about generosity in lots of different ways. And so it doesn't require you to do the challenge. You can talk about giving to another cause or thinking in different ways. So I would use it as a moment to talk to kids about why people are doing this and fashion it in your own way. I think the caller has a good point, but there are ways to spin it in a different direction and really encourage charitable giving.
Social media brings out this new dynamic where you can name people and call them out in a way that's personal and public at the same time. Is that the future of giving? Both, it's, you know, it's encouragement, but there is also a kind of a, you know, cudgel held over people's heads here. Is that where we're headed in the social media age, Stacey?
Peer pressure has always been a part of charitable giving. It's friends asking friends. United Way raises money at work and everybody's giving. So that's been really part of the tradition. So I don't think there's anything really new, and it's incredibly powerful. One of the things a lot of nonprofits have done is built systems that make it easier for people to raise money from their friends. This is a whole lot more powerful when you ask somebody you know to give rather than a staff member from a charity calls you. It's also a lot less expensive for the nonprofit to be able to enlist all these volunteer fundraisers. Think about the little amount of money that they have spent on this. That's the other phenomenal part. It's not just how much they raised, but how little it took them to do it.
I mean, it's true that they have almost no investment here. People just taking this and running with it. The flip side of that, I guess, is what's the organizing principle for making this happen? This almost came out of the clear blue sky to rain this $50 million plus down on the ALS Association. How does any other group say, well, we want to do that too? You know, it's not that easy to start a wave like this.
That's precisely the question, and that's why most nonprofits are trying to look at what the lessons are rather than saying they can just copy this. They need to figure out what is it that goes viral. But learning how to tap friends, relatives, people who care about certain causes, we know that that works, but trying to find a way to muster that. There's no way that it's going to work for other people to just keep adopting this challenge. We need to start thinking about new things already.
Gail in Pittsville, Wisconsin. Gail, thanks for calling. What do you think of the Ice Bucket Challenge?
Actually, my son, we're hosting one at our little community today, 785 people, and apparently there's going to be like 1,000 people showing up today.
And they're all going to get doused?
Doused or donate.
Wow.
We're a pretty little small town, yeah. And my son, his good friend from high school has ALS, and I think he's had it for about 2.5 years. We do a community fundraiser for him and ALS, and this is just another step. And social media, oh my gosh, it's out there.
A whole lot of ice water coming down today in Pittsville, Wisconsin. Going to be a lot of chilly people there, but also probably a lot of money raised. One more. Thank you, Gail. One more, if I may. Emma in Boston. Hi, Emma. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. So my husband actually has an uncle who passed away from ALS a couple years ago, and I was very moved by meeting him. He was a great man. At first, the Ice Bucket Challenge really bothered me because I felt like it was more sexy to dump the ice bucket over your head than to donate money. And it really bothered me. And now that I've seen what it's done, this $50 million, I feel I've really changed my opinion. And I feel we should just be grateful that it's out there. And even if it can't be replicated with other charities, that, you know, at least this phenomenon actually, you know, happens, and that, you know, it's something really cool and we're talking about it. And hopefully people are now aware of what ALS is and aware of more charity and what they can do for charity.
Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS. Did you also hear this word slacktivism that went around in some critical circles earlier, Emma?
I did. I've always had a real problem with, you know, people. I had a problem with the yellow ribbons that, you know, after 9/11 that were made in China, and the money actually wasn't going to the troops. It was just slapping it on your car because it was sexy, you know, and I've always had a problem with those. I've always felt like you should find a way to give if something really reaches you.
And not necessarily when you get to show off your wet T-shirt or your pecs or your likes on Facebook, but the 50 million's won you over.
What's that?
The 50 million has won you over in spite of that early reservation.
Has. I mean, it surprised me, and it has really won me over, yes.
Emma, I appreciate your call very much, especially with somebody in the family actually, you know, brought down here by ALS. Stacey Palmer in Washington, the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Please stand by there. With us from Los Angeles right now is Michael Hiltzik. He is a business columnist at the LA Times. Wrote a kind of skeptical column about the Ice Bucket Challenge. Headline, A Few Impolite Questions About the Ice Bucket Challenge. Michael, thanks very much for being with us. What was at the heart of your skeptical approach?
Well, the questions that I asked that I think really are concerns that everybody in philanthropy should be having about this are first of all, whether this sort of publicity campaign is the best way to apportion and direct what are essentially finite resources, and also whether this is a sustainable model for any one given charity. And I think Stacey has raised this issue in the pages of her own publication. It's celebrity-driven. It's PR-driven. I think it's pretty clear that the ALS Association is not going to be raising $50 million every year. And since this is money that's being contributed by people who aren't really required to take the time to think about where their money is going, whether it's going to the right place, whether, in fact, ALS needs the money as much as other causes may need it, that it may be working against really good philanthropic principles.
I mean, you can sound kind of like a party pooper there, Michael. It's a lot of money raised, even if it doesn't happen again. As Nancy Frady said at the top of the hour, they built a huge database of contributors. And do you really think that if people give $10 or $100 here, that's going to be subtracted directly from what they might give to every and anything else in the course of a year?
Well, I think it's a well-understood principle, and Stacey can talk about this if you want to ask her, that in fact there are limited resources. $50 million that goes to ALS, some portion of that would have gone to other causes over time. People who end up on this database, on this mailing list, are they going to be giving money year after year after year to ALS? I think that's probably doubtful for most people. And so the question is, how do you build a sustainable base of supporters for a cause like this? And I'm not sure that doing it through basically a social media blockbuster is really going to be the best answer over time.
Stacey, do you see a zero-sum game here? If people come out, you know, wet and chilly and give to ALS, we'll see less money available for other causes? And what about the sustainability issue?
I hope that's not the case, but I do have those concerns. We see that charitable giving never goes up by huge amounts every year. It's a fixed percentage of national income that goes to charitable causes. And nonprofits haven't really figured out how to boost that up. And I think that's why they've been looking at social media to say, is there any way that we can encourage people to give more and to think in different ways? So this is not the answer to everything, but $50 million is a huge amount of money for a cause that would have trouble breaking through in any other kind of way. So for them, it's very important. And if other groups can be encouraged to say, maybe we can innovate and look at different ways, then that will be important. We'll also be watching what they do to encourage donors to keep giving. So that will be important to see whether they'll be repeating. But the other question is, you know, how much more is needed for research at this moment? So is $50 million a really good start for them? And maybe people can start looking at other causes that also need a lot of help.
Yeah, and somehow maybe get an organized approach, but then this is organic and huge. Caroline in Milwaukee. Caroline, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Hi. Actually, I am just very, very happy to see all the attention being given to ALS, no matter what form it's taking. My mother-in-law died at age 59, and I watched her disintegrate through that illness. And I felt that there was not a lot of attention given to that illness, even after she passed away, and I would, you know, be much more alert to it. Cancer does, and a lot of other, even MS, but ALS just didn't seem to be out in the forefront. So whatever form this is taking, I think it's fantastic. It's an educational source for a lot of people also.
Yeah, one way or another. Two thumbs up from Caroline. I appreciate your call in Milwaukee, Caroline. One more right here. Thank you. Liberty, Kentucky, Tim is calling. Tim, you're on the air.
Hey, man, what's going on, Tom?
Well, we're just looking at this amazing explosion of giving here. What have you seen?
Well, yesterday in a little town just west of me called Campbellsville, Kentucky, their marching band at the Campbellsville College was doing one of these ALS challenges, and they had incorporated the aid of the fire department. And they had the ladder truck up and the little bucket on the ladder, you know, was raised up in the air, and they were, you know, doing this thing. And somebody was obviously got too excited about the situation that was going on, got too close to a power line, got into that electromagnetic aura, and it arced over to the truck. One of the firefighters is actually right now, he's still in critical condition. One's in serious condition. And two were sent to the hospital and treated and basically sent back home. So this is a great thing, really. I mean, to bring attention to something like this and to help raise money to do research to benefit the people who suffer from it. But, you know, please, if you're going to plan some kind of a stunt, be really careful.
Tim, I think I heard about this on NPR News this morning. They were actually dumping from the fire truck ladder when the electricity arced and burned the firemen.
Exactly. I mean, water and electricity just love each other.
Boy, talk about going grand scale when the whole fire truck and ladder and everything else is involved. But as you say, firemen ended up burnt there. I mean, be careful. Keep your wits about you as you're going with the ice water. I appreciate your call, Tim. Michael, is that where you'd point and say, boy, this is out of control? You got firemen getting, you know, seriously injured on fire trucks? Or is that just, hey, hooray for all the enthusiasm here?
Well, I think that's sort of a side issue. The real issue is what sort of commitment people who make contributions this way really are making, and whether this sort of campaign really encourages people or discourages them from making the sort of inquiry into where they're donating that they really should be. Look, there's been a lot of talk here about how ALS is a misunderstood or forgotten or an underappreciated condition and how devastating it is. And it is devastating, obviously, to its sufferers mm-hmm. and their families and their caregivers. But the question is, how many of these donors have really looked at it and said, is there really this sort of need for donations to ALS, or are there other causes that may be more in need? How many of these donors have looked at the ALS Association and said, are they equipped really to deploy $50 million? I mean, this is an organization that last year collected less than $6 million in unrestricted cash. If you're now showering this windfall of $50 million or more on them, and it might be $80 million or $100 million before we're done, what are the chances that this becomes a burden and that, in fact, they are unable to deploy it in the most effective and efficient way possible? These are all inquiries that I think responsible donors would want to make, but they're not doing it. They're not going to do it when they're contributing in this particular fashion.
When social media gets up and in gear like this, I guess nobody's exactly steering this, but it's a lot of giving, and that in some ways speaks for itself. Michael Hiltzik, you raise interesting issues from the LA Times. We appreciate your joining us today. Thanks for being with us, Michael.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Ice Bucket Challenge, the summer's wild viral fundraiser for ALS and the future of giving in the age of social media. We're going to look a little bit before this hour is over at Facebook and Twitter and how their roles are shaking out in this era. Facebook exploded with the Ice Bucket Challenge. Twitter exploded with Ferguson, and it's kind of an interesting fork in the road there. Stacey Palmer is with us, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. People doing this all over the place. I mean, just, it seems like every celebrity has done it. Lots of business people, politicians jumping on it as well. Democratic Representative Joe Kennedy of Massachusetts accepting the Ice Bucket Challenge in honor of Pete Frates.
Let's strike out ALS.
cold, a little sign of ice there. And Republican Governor, Louisiana's Governor Bobby Jindal here, taking the ice bucket challenge, promising to donate, calling out others to do it.
I want to thank Drew Brees for challenging me to take the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. I'm happy to accept in honor of Team Gleason. I'll also be making a donation to the ALS Foundation. I want to challenge Coach Les Miles, Willie Robertson, and Joe Scarborough. You've got 24 hours.
24 hours, and that challenge has gone on all over the place. Yes, I've been challenged. I'm giving. I'm not dousing. Okay, Bruce in Bedford, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I think this ice bucket challenge is a fabulous thing. I'm a little upset with some of the people that have found fault with it. ALS is considered an orphan disease because out of a sample population of, say, 100,000 people, 549 will have some form of cancer. But out of that same 100,000 person population, only two will get ALS. And my wife passed away from ALS 5 years ago. Oh. And, we were married for 20 years. I have two kids. I've got one in college down in Louisiana. So I'm glad to hear the governor down there is doing the ice bucket challenge.
So you know how tough it is, Bruce. And you might have felt lonely sometimes with that.
Yes, yeah, a lot of people, when you try to explain to them ALS, or you'd say, well, Lou Gehrig's disease, and they'd say, oh, yeah, I've heard of that, but people would have no idea what it was. And so I just think this is fabulous that people are, the awareness, the money, I can't get over the amount of money that they've raised because the big pharmaceutical companies didn't want to do much of anything because their customer base was so small. So I think this is just great.
A lot of awareness and a lot of money both, Bruce. We wish your family well and hope there's some solace in seeing so many people rally around it. Got lots of people online here applauding this, lots of people who have done it, others who are saying, huge waste of water or enough already with everything going viral. No one thinks for themselves anymore. Well, here's one big gusher of giving. I want to go to the ALS Association, the chief scientist there, to ask about what might be done with this money. Dr. Lucy Bruin joins us right now from Washington. Dr. Bruin, thanks for being here. This is a lot of money, $50 million plus already headed your way. How much of it will go to research? Can you handle, can you use that volume of funds? And give us some sense of where research stands on ALS, Dr. Bruin.
Hello, Tom. Yes, I'm pleased to help address some of the questions, and thank you to all the good comments, and most importantly, I think the comments of how important it has been for awareness. It is tremendous to see that so many more people know about this very difficult and devastating disease, and certainly the funding is incredibly important for us to make progress. So I would say, first of all, I think that the reality that it costs so much to do any of the research, it's important to put into perspective. For some of the clinical trials to even see if these treatments work, it can cost from the smaller trials to $25 million and the bigger trials $80 million. So developing treatments for any disease is incredibly costly. There's been tremendous progress in ALS research. It couldn't be a better time, indeed. Because so much scientific discoveries have been made, and there are tremendous advances in technology that have enabled us to do such good research. So I'm sure our organization is obviously looking carefully to see strategically how to invest the funds in the best way. But we have very strong structured programs we fund in multiple areas, and we know now that we will be able to really expand that. We fund globally and have 98 current projects all over the world, and we just haven't been able to fund all the good science going on. So through strategic discussions, I know we're going to invest significantly to make sure we develop treatments as quickly as possible for a difficult disease.
Could you give us a layman's description of, if there are promising avenues, give us one, the science of it, in layman's terms, if you can, that might get at the physical issues that bring on ALS and how they might be reversed or changed or prevented?
Those are more difficult, but I will just add that we understand that 5 to 10% of ALS is caused by genetics, so that it runs through the family, and we have identified almost 60% of the genes that are linked to ALS. And at least for those, we have specifically know that if we can affect that genetic mutation in what goes wrong, we are very likely to significantly slow the disease. And hopefully, if we can discover it really early, because it's carried through families, treat really early to delay or even prevent the disease. For those for which there is not a known cause of the disease, obviously their prevention is much more difficult. But we do focus on the genetic findings. We've made remarkable findings in the last few years and are actually driving towards developing a therapy around that. And through our funding and our partnerships with the industry and academia, there's been a lot more interest in the industry to develop these treatments, and we're going to slowly see these new novel approaches come into the clinic.
Dr. Lucy Bruin, chief scientist at the ALS Association, with a lot of fresh resources flowing her way. Dr. Bruin, thanks for being with us for a couple of minutes here.
Thank you, Tom.
Julia, in Beverly, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Julia.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay, what do you see?
Well, what I see when I work with my clients, I do consulting specifically around social media for nonprofit organizations. I think that a lot of nonprofit professionals are missing the whole point of why the Ice Bucket Challenge succeeded. It succeeded because it wasn't even really ALS, it was Pete Frates, who's from my hometown in Beverly, Mass. So that's why it resonated with me. But it really works because it's a peer-to-peer app. And it's emotional appeal. So what nonprofits try to do is they try to pigeonhole donors to where they want them to be. So we send direct mail, we do events, we write grants. But donors are online, they're on social media, and they're listening to their friends. So word of mouth is the most popular form and the most powerful form of fundraising, and that's why it succeeded. So
what about the concerns we've heard in this hour that, hey, great, it's a lot of money, but it'll come out of other pockets, and it may not be well considered? It's a wave, but a wave can go anywhere.
I don't know. I say too bad. Other nonprofits, you have to get on board. You have to get in gear. You know, you have to stop whining and stop saying, oh, ALS did this and we can't do that and we can't do this. I see tiny nonprofits every single day doing amazing things and reaching out and connecting with their donors in fantastic and creative ways. So I think the whole sector just kind of needs to look at the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge and really learn from it and say, what can we do? Not to replicate it, but what are the aspects of it that is so successful, and what can we do in our fundraising to kind of adapt and emulate it?
Julia, I appreciate your call. Stacey, we've just got a couple of minutes here. What takeaways do you have for other people in philanthropic pursuits who may be trying to cure diseases or you name it? They're looking at this, and on the one hand, they must be awed by the speed and scale of what's been raised. On the other, they might be frightened by how it seems almost, you can't predict where this glory is going to land, and how do you provoke it? How do you do it yourself?
I think that's one of the things nonprofits need to think about, is that you can't always predict it and they can't control it. And that's a wonderful thing in some ways when it spreads like wildfire because people care about it. As our caller just said, word of mouth has always been a very important thing to tap. So trying to figure out ways to get people to talk about things and to really focus on what interests the donor rather than what interests the nonprofit. Nonprofits sometimes talk inside baseball in a way that really doesn't help donors get emotionally involved or decide that they want to give. So I think that's the lesson to learn from it. Also, what's interesting about this is this is a really tough disease, and trying to think about people suffering with it, we've already heard from some of those people during the hour. To some people, it seemed unseemly that you do something that's sort of fun and you're giving to a serious disease, but maybe that combination makes people feel a little bit better about giving in some kind of way. I think it's taught a lot of nonprofits to say maybe they can do some fun things. And we've seen other groups working on really serious causes also looking at ways maybe they can inject a little humor. That's not such a bad thing. Sometimes those things can go together.
Here's Lori writing us on Twitter saying, this summer's news is so grim, makes us feel powerless. Ice Bucket Challenge makes us feel we can do something. And I think there's a lot of truth right there in that. Stacey Palmer, editor at the Chronicle of Philanthropy, thanks a lot for being with us. Have you done it, Stacey?
I have not done it. Please don't tag me.
Okay, no peer pressure here, but on goes that way. 50 million plus and still going. Stacey, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
In a moment, we'll look at how Facebook and Twitter are defining their roles in different directions, from the Ice Bucket Challenge to Ferguson, Missouri. This is On Point. This summer, the Ice Bucket Challenge took Facebook by storm, dominated the Facebook newsfeed. But a click away on Twitter, the events in Ferguson, Missouri were the hot item. That was not random, says John McDermott, reporter for DigiDay. His article's headline is Why Facebook is for Ice Buckets and Twitter is for Ferguson. John McDermott, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What have you seen unfold here? What's been revealed about the character or purpose or focus of these two huge social media juggernauts?
Well, I think there's two things at play here. The first being just kind of a difference in tone between these two different social media properties. You know, Facebook is a place where people share these kind of very happy, feel-good parts of their lives. They share baby photos and they announce their engagements. Mm-hmm. And Ice Bucket, being relatively more popular than Ferguson on Facebook, kind of speaks to that those feel-good emotions. Twitter has been and remains to be a great place for breaking news and to, you know, continue dispatches from the front lines. And obviously, as the events in Ferguson have played out over the last 2 weeks, you know, that kind of speaks to that use case. More so than on Facebook.
What about the relative weight of these two on the two different sites, Facebook and Twitter? How did they show up? Do you have any metrics on that?
Yes, I do, actually. The way I kind of approach the story was that anecdotally I started seeing people tweet out that their Facebook feeds were all about Ice Bucket and that their Twitter feeds were all about Ferguson. So then I went to analytics companies. Social media has kind of given rise to this cottage industry of analytics companies that, you know, mm-hmm. analyze conversations on Facebook and Twitter and elsewhere, and then take that information to advertisers so they can get, you know, the biggest bang for their buck. And when I asked them to compare Ice Bucket to Ferguson, what we found on Facebook is that stories about the Ice Bucket Challenge were driving nearly 9 times as many referrals to websites than stories about Ferguson. And that stories about Ice Bucket Challenge were also being interacted with, liked, shared, commented upon at a higher rate than stories about Ferguson.
Okay. And when you went to Twitter?
And when we went to Twitter, just the sheer number of tweets about Ferguson was about there were about 1 million more tweets about Ferguson than there were about Ice Bucket over the time we studied, which was about a week and a half.
What about Twitter's power just to raise this up to the point where it gets on the national screen, gets picked up by the big media rivers here? We saw Twitter almost push Ferguson itself into the evening news and front page.
Indeed, and it was kind of a story that the mainstream media picks up on as a function of its popularity on Twitter. And that just kind of speaks to how Twitter's kind of influence on culture and the news media specifically is far larger than the number of users on there. I mean, it was pretty amazing, actually.
What do you think is most effective on Twitter in making that happen? Is it just the volume of chatter about a particular incident? Is it that people are tagging news editors and reporters and saying, look at this? Is it the visual images?
I think it's really a function that people in the news media use Twitter so much that kind of bubbles its way up into our culture. And, you know, just the basic use case of 140 characters lends itself very well to a story about Ferguson, where things are kind of breaking constantly, and, you know, sending that short kind of dispatch from your phone is ideal for Twitter.
So what's the division of labor here then that you see? Twitter's more literally a news feed, and Facebook is more literally a social feed?
I think that's exactly it. I mean, Facebook is, you know, it's very personal. And to have kind of a very frank conversation about the militarization of the police and America's kind of painful racial history alongside all of these kind of feel-good personal items, it's a little incongruous. It would feel a little awkward, I think, for a lot of people.
It's funny that that comes up just now, because it was only a few weeks ago that Facebook was on fire with all kinds of commentary about Israel and Gaza. And because it was so social, a lot of those became fraught interactions, people being, you know, unfriended over very much a news story.
Yeah, it's interesting. And that kind of played out on Twitter as well. It'll be interesting to see how Facebook becomes a place for these conversations, because they have definitely made changes to how they distribute media and their kind of their algorithm and how it values news stories in kind of a way to become a more kind of veritable news source.
Our personal lives and our public lives being driven by social media and online feeds here, personal by Facebook in very big ways lately, even unto the dumping of a bucket of ice water, and Twitter putting Ferguson on the national news map in a very, very big way before the news media were really focused there. John McDermott has written it all up for DigiDay in Why Facebook is for Ice Buckets and Twitter is for Ferguson. John, in New York City, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gale Rosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Abigail Collins and Madeline Moore. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. You can follow the conversation, get our podcast at the website onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at onpointradio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR on Twitter. Thanks for being with us today. This is On Point. Thank you.